coming back to Two Pints in the Corner.
Yeah, Two Pints in the Corner.
With Dinky Dawson and me, Tony Raine, and we got a special guest with us this week, and hopefully for the next few of these, a friend of ours, Tim Miller, who is a renowned journalist, critic, film critic, and been a friend of both of ours for many, many years. So we brought Tim in here to try to keep us under control and ask him pertinent questions and keep us on track. Otherwise, we'll be all over the place. So last time we talked a little bit about what the channel was to us and the scene and how we saw it contribute to the Boston music scene. And we're going to talk a little bit. I think today we were just talking about all the different genres of music,
yeah,
and types of things the channel did. And I think what Dinky and I agree on was the perspective we would get from seeing the different crowds that went along with the different types of music.
Totally.
I mean, I think the club was a different thing to different crowds. If you were a metal freak, you were there for one reason. If you were stage diving for something else, and if you were there to see a reggae show, you had another vibe on it.
Yeah.
But we'd sit there and look at the place every day and try to change the tone to fit the gig.
Well, how did that evolve? How did it become sort of multi-genre?
I think necessity from the owners. I mean, we weren't there until the mid-80s, but in the early 80s, if you were in the nightclub business in Boston, the local scene was starting to flourish. So bars were booking local bands.
Yeah.
Bands needed somewhere to play. And everybody was doing local Boston music to a degree. Berkeley contributed a lot. And the clubs around Kenmore were hinged around Berkeley, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The clubs around Cambridge would have been hinged around Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't a scene for sort of the street kids in Southie.
Yeah.
So I think it started to develop out of that. And then the main entertainment clubs in town were Lansdowne Street, the old Boston Tea Party, which had booked, and then the clubs over in Cambridge, Jonathan Swift's, and beyond that, before that, there were the jazz clubs and the other places that are Chamberlain Square and Harvard Square. And I think the guys at the Channel, God love them, took whatever those guys didn't take that were becoming touring acts.
Mm-hmm.
So it established itself as a home for hardcore music, reggae, world beat, bands that, you know, were at that point been big names, but they were too small to sell out big venues.
Yeah.
So they'd take a chance on whatever they could get.
Yeah.
And it just became a real mixed genre. You could be in there one night with James Brown, and the night after or the month after, you know, the Big Audio Dynamite would be in there.
Right.
It was all over the place,
and the audiences would change with the acts.
They'd buy tickets. We advance ticket sales.
But what I mean is we were talking
all things on the world music side of, especially I met this young man there called Black Star Liner, doing the DJ, who will come on this podcast and talk to you guys about King Sonny Arday, the pasting. That I'll leave you with that word, pasting. Now, you've got to learn that.
Yeah.
It's called pasting. You've never seen anything like it. It's called pasting. I'm going to get him to tell you all about that. And his Yellow Man story, when he had to pick him up in his Volkswagen at the airport.
Kevin Elmer was the Black Star Liner, and probably next to Roger, I think Roger Staffens, I think he's the number two reggae expert in the country.
Oh, I would say. I mean, he has more recordings of the reggae artists from Jimmy Cliff. Got 3-4 hours of recording with Jimmy.
And I've got to be honest, that's what appealed to me, because again, throwing back to England in 68, 69, reggae didn't hit in this country until Bob Marley after the Rainbow concert in England, and Clapton and those guys endorsed him. But to us, we were listening to Desmond Dekker in 1969-70. I remember dancing to Prince Buster's Al Capone when I was 14 at a youth club.
I still have them all. I love them. They were all scars and stuff.
They were all part of that Northern Soul stuff.
Exactly. It was phenomenal.
And that's where the bands like General Public and UB40 and everybody else had got their influences.
In the circle, I had them out later on when I decided I'd go out touring, but not with the system, just with them.
Right. You took Inner Circle on the road after a chat.
Took them on the road when we did this thing called Bad Boys.
I remember that, yeah.
But the bottom line about it is, it was a scene. The scene the channel.
There was a good scene from here right through till it closed.
Oh, even the metal bands. The scene with the metal bands and the Italians and all those women. Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's the key to a good venue, I think, is that it can be a different place. Every night to a different clientele.
I mean, you had the new music nights, but you also had, you said, as a reggae night, there was. Now, for instance, on a Sunday afternoon, we did a group called Striper.
Yep.
And that's the kids came down from New Hampshire with 4,000 Bibles or two and whatever. That was the audience.
The Born Again Rock.
Born Again Rock. And then at night, we had a reggae band.
Born Again Hair Rock.
Hair metal. Hair metal. At that time, it was all big hair. Big hair. And who would outdo the bouffant?
I used to joke about the dressing room that you walk in and it looked like there were stalagmites hanging from the ceiling and it was hairspray.
that was a fun time. But it was a scene, you see. So even people would come to the channel from work in the afternoon, for the bar would open in the afternoon in the front.
Yeah,
for people, and they come out from work just to sit there and sit and see what we were doing in the sound checks.
Well, we'd a mixed audience because it was a good local club for South Boston.
Oh yeah.
So we had a regular hangout crowd that would come no matter what was going on because they weren't particularly music fans, but they'd come because they knew something would be going on. And then you had the followers, the bands that followed.
Exactly. It was.
And what's changed, I think, a lot with the clubs is that I don't think you see kids going to clubs now for the sake of just going to the club.
Not really.
Socialising. They go specifically to buy a ticket and see a headline band. But that was a big part of, definitely for me growing up, and you, I know, because we started with that with the youth club. We started doing that when we were 12, 13 years old. I'd go to the youth club on Saturday night, play records and have a Coke and play badminton or whatever was going on. But we were all only there to meet girls, let's face it.
Always.
That was always the score. But you got used to the social aspect of it. And I think to a degree that's vanishing from the concert business.
Well, it is.
You know, it's kind of sad. People tend to go out now and they're paying so much for tickets. They think they're in their own bubble. They think the show is just for them. You know, they're not social. I think festivals are working.
And what the older crowd are doing is going out to restaurants. So the people are doing, like, duos in restaurants. Yeah, and it's a band on a Saturday night and stuff.
And it's seated. It's not standing and mixing and talking and dancing.
There was no seats in the channel unless it was on the deck. As soon as you walked in the door, there was like a...
There were a few. We put a few more in when we took it over in the 80s when we redecorated a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I didn't do any pop art like I did in the Mojo.
Well, I did a little bit. I remember I went out and I bought all those broken instruments.
Oh.
All those broken violins and old acoustic instruments, and I sprayed them all silver and put a black light on them over the bar, and then we redid the DJ booth with scaffolding.
And camouflage net. Where's the music coming from? It's behind the damn camouflage.
Pissed everybody off, but it looked great.
It was great.
I put a parachute silk in the back room. You remember that?
remember we put the back room in there and there was groups in there that had never played anywhere.
Right, and then I went back in. When we went back in, I left in 87 and I went back in 91, and that year I took the back room and we called it Vertigo.
Yeah.
And I brought Joey Mars in and a couple of the Asa Brebner and a couple of the Boston artists and gave them one wall each. and it looked like, I don't know what it looked like. It was great. It looked like Vertigo.
Yeah.
And that was before U2's Vertigo album. We called it Vertigo.
But anyway, they play their big gigs and then still come down here. A lot of the groups that played Boston Garden would come down here.
Yeah.
Fleetwood, Christine McVie, and all that time would come down to see me.
People would have to have a look. They'd have to come in and have a look, you know.
Oh, and then we had special nights. We'll talk about some of them too later in the podcast.
The free lunches.
Oh, the BCN stuff were fantastic.
I used to say that my favourite line was always, what was it? It was a dollar beer, I think, and a free hot dog. And we used to say, do you know what's in a hot dog? Now imagine what's in a free one.
Oh yeah, that was yeah, I remember that one. So anyway, the other thing is, just so people know this, is that in 2007, I ended up getting buying the trademark for the channel.
Right.
And that's when we started this website called bostonsbestliverock.com. which is the channel. And a lot of people really liked to see some of the videos that were done. A lot of the new music bands posted a few videos up there and what have you, and we're going to put more up.
Yeah, you should look at that. I got in the internet business, I think, about then.
Yeah.
And I actually bought that address for you.
Yeah.
And I'd realised when I saw the CBGB stuff
yeah.
going on sale and being sort of celebrated after Hilly Crystal got out, that there was going to be a legacy.
That was down here in the Cape here with Paula.
Yeah, I was on the Cape with Paula, and as I said, if they, fortunately or unfortunately, they never registered the trademark.
No,
and I remember saying to you, register the trademark, there's going to be a legacy there. People are going to be interested, we think. And then, God love you, Dinky, you did a lot of work.
On
compiling that database, which Dinky, people don't realise, but if you go on that website and peel away the layers of the onion and get into the year by year, that's the most accurate record of everybody that played at the channel. And Dinky got into that with the archives at the Boston Phoenix.
We
had a ton of help there from Brad.
From Brad,
Brad Mendich,
Brad
who was
Mendich
running.
And actually, the Black Star Liner came in with me too.
And then Kevin, the Black Star Liner, came up with the reggae stuff. It's a very comprehensive record of everybody who played the club. And basically, that's what's jugging our memories.
It sure is.
And we're going to kind of take that list apart over the next few episodes of this and try to bring you some of our favourite moments. Yeah. So there's plenty of stuff to work on, and I'm sure you've got your own memories, we'll set up a way on that website for you to share them with us, and hopefully we can keep the name of the place alive.
Yeah, and there's some people that work there that still love what's going on, and they'll come and talk with us about this.
We have some guests. I mean, the place was heavily involved in the Boston scene. Particularly late on, we had, you know, we always had local celebrity DJs there every night from BCN and from FNX and from the stations at the time.
But the BCN lunch was always good.
The free lunches were good. We did some benefits.
The people, though, that were there from Tank to Mark Parento to Carter Allen, who wrote my book with me. I mean, great stuff.
I just did a show this summer with George Thorogood on his 50th anniversary tour.
Ah.
And George was in there doing a benefit lunch show, I think.
Yeah, it was.
Back then, back in 86.
Yeah.
It was one of his regular stops. You know, I have some great memories of stuff. Like I worked with the Black Crowes a couple of times, and they reminded me that they played for us at the channel. And met us in there and started out.
Well, I heard that John Entwistle and Lemmy did the same thing.
Same thing, yeah.
In the bar together in LA.
I'll tell you that story. I met them in 91 in the Rainbow Room. And jugged their memory. And Buddy Guy.
Memory of the channel and Lemmy. I've just brought it up, but we'll talk about it when we specifically go through individual.
Yeah, we'll put those in context. We're going to try to do this, I think, a little bit by genres, right?
So exactly.
We'll start with our first episode, and we'd like to talk about world beat and the diverse stuff that we did in there, from Jimmy Cliff to Peter Tosh to
King Sunny R Day
to it was really the only
Steel
room
Pulse.
in the 80s for world beat music.
It was great for that. Yeah. And they were all passing through, and the thing is that the other promoters in the town weren't interested in doing what we were doing.
Well, they weren't, and they weren't that interested in hardcore back then. No. Or, I remember, talk about turning your head around. We'd go in there and do the Circle Jerks or something on a Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. And at 7 o'clock, Muda Baruka or somebody was coming.
Exactly.
It was a complete change of crowd and switch your head round.
That's why I kept thinking about
it. It was
that.
Insane.
It was. Get them out, get them in.
It was great.
But the fun part about it is that it was a scene. And that's what we grew up with as kids, as scenes.
Yep.
You know, I mean, my wife had grown up in the folk scene. I grew up in the pop rock scene.
Right.
Blues, the English white blues scene.
Well, it was a good time. The 80s were an interesting time in music, I think, because that's when the genre splits really started to happen. I mean, to the point where, you know, we'd had pop and R&B.
Yeah.
And blues and jazz and folk. Then all of a sudden it was hard rock.
Hard rock, very hard.
Which that turned into heavy metal.
Heavy metal.
Which then turned into thrash metal, death metal.
I learned five different metals at that place, I'll tell you.
Hardcore stuff had turned into, you know, the pub rock was another element that came through.
But industrial stuff too, you know, that came through. And then you got people like Billy Bragg. Came, so.
And the punk stuff, the artsy stuff. I mean, you know, Wendy O. Williams and the Plasmatics.
That was great.
The Damned.
Cut up all that damn thing.
Yeah. And then on a local scene, we supported heavily.
Was it
a local punk scene?
Chopped up?
Yeah, Wendy O. came in, and the rider had, the first time she came in, the rider had the shell of a Volkswagen Beetle.
Oh.
And we had to get a Volkswagen Beetle and put it on stage. And she cut it up with a chainsaw. And then the second time, she had a mannequin dressed as Boy George.
Yeah, that's the one.
And she cut that up with a chainsaw.
Yeah, I like that one. I remember that one.
And she was the nicest woman I ever dealt with. She was a strict vegetarian, didn't drink, didn't do drugs. I had to go out. I remember going to Cambridge to buy duck eggs for the rider and having to get a yoga mat for her to work out on. And then in the 80s, that was like, who is this?
There's all that, but the fun stuff like, you know, the performance groups like Gwar.
Yeah.
When they came through, I have to tell you guys out there, that band, as much as they put fake blood all over everybody in the audience, they protected all my damn sound equipment with tarps and stuff. And not only that, they cleaned up. They're the first group and only group that ever cleaned the stage of duct tape, of this, of that, and the other. Them guys were really, really, really cool in all aspects of life. I thought it was fantastic.
I have a great story about cleaning up in there. Because I was running the bars, and I was there every night. New music nights were a bit dismal a lot of times, because basically we were just trying to keep the venue
open,
alive. So we'd book five bands,
We'd
give them all tickets, and they'd get paid based on however many people showed up.
Yeah.
And all kinds of bands, everybody wanted to play the room. And it was a lot of fun, but it was, you know, there'd be two of us in there on a snowy night in February, nobody drinking, and we'd have to sit there, and Dave Wentland would be there, or Paul, or one of the sound guys. We'd sit there and suffer through five bands.
That's right, Paul Hagar was there.
Paul Hagar, who's with Miley Cyrus,
was
started his career in there. And
Pullman, he's with Country.
One particular night in winter, there was a band from New Hampshire booked to play the last slot, which was midnight, I think. And it was a Monday or a Tuesday or a Wednesday night. I'm trying to remember. They were called the Flying 69. And they came in, and they thought they were Kiss. So they had full outfits, the stacked boots, silver outfits, face paint.
Oh, my.
The works, totally dressed to kill. So the guys get up there to give it rice about 11:30. And it's their big night out from New Hampshire. They're playing Boston, they're playing the Channel and everything. And they get up on the stage and I see the guy and he's got a stack of about 500 flyers advertising the next shows or wherever they're playing. And there's nobody in the club to see him. Nobody, not a soul. But they rehearse the act so tight, they get up there, they give it their 40 minutes, and he comes to the front of the stage with all the flyers and he throws them out to no crowd, where he imagined there was a crowd. Trash all over the floor. And as he was coming off the stage, I went over and stuck the broom in his hand and said, now go clean it up.
All right, I got one for you. So you've got that one. I'll tell you my fun one. It's called the Butthole Surfers.
Yeah.
Now, these guys wanted, I mean, we had to rent a huge projector. Cost hundreds of dollars just to rent this thing. They showed this massive picture of movie of a guy getting his thingy chopped off. and they were playing music to it.
Yeah.
Then this little girl comes on and as a sumo. She got a sumo bottom on and half the top was half naked. She's dancing away and all of a sudden she takes a cup of peas in it and drinks it.
Ooh.
I said to myself, I have to tell you this because the next one was even worse. Gibby, the guitarist, decides he wanted to show off what was going on. He got a cymbal on the drums, he poured lighter fluid on it, set fire to it. The next thing he did that, I threw him out the back door with his guitar and his amplifier and locked the door behind him. I says, that's it. You're not going to set fire to this club, you buggers. You know, and that was the last time I ever saw anything to do with the Butthole Surfers had gone. I said, you know, it's all right to do performance up, but that's gross.
Oh, there's but we were open for anything.
Well, like I said, yeah, open for anything. It was like on a Sunday afternoon we do. It was just fun. Sunday afternoons when you started bringing in the all the flea markets.
Yeah,
stuff.
We tried stuff. That was an idea that I think we were way ahead of ourselves when we did the the Bizarre Bazaar.
Oh, that was good. It was bizarre.
And we put five bands on, and I remember Unas from Cambridge, they use clothing places. Yeah. So we were trying to set up a flea market with live music on Sunday afternoons in summer. We went a few weeks, I think, but it was an idea that was way ahead of itself.
But the other thing that was way ahead of its time is heavy metal Christmas for the kids.
Yeah.
When we'd open Christmas Day for the kids to come in the afternoon to listen to heavy metal bands.
Oh, God, that was after me, I think. I only remember those Sunday. My worst memory of a Sunday afternoon was a kid stage diving and everybody moved back.
Wow, no!
And he went head first into the floor.
Oh, that's that big. Oh, no.
And then I had to find his. Because we did all ages.
Yeah.
There were kids. I was calling parents and trying to get people. I remember a few of those incidents. But,
we had signs up saying no stage diving, but you see the thing was is they'd hang on the on the rafters because the metal bars.
We had signs up that said no drugs too. But.
We had signs everywhere, but it was a hotbed in every level. Even the Centurion Club, which is the police Centurion, renting it for
their
crazy night.
The police were very good to us. I do remember doing the bikers were good to us.
Oh, the Hell's Angel guys were fantastic in that place.
Yeah,
they really looked after the place. They loved the music that they brought in and stuff. And John Messina with that lot. You know,
I think that was the coolest thing about the place was everybody, the crowds or the different audiences, all thought they had a different ownership.
Aye.
For a different reason. They thought it was their club because that was their scene that night.
Yeah.
But from our perspective, the scene was changing every day.
Every day.
Yeah.
No matter, you know, 4 o'clock came around in the afternoon and I was loading in or whatever they were loading in and this, that and the other, and I'm going, scene's changed again.
No, that's what I've always liked, and I took that with me for for the last few years when I've been working South Shore was just that, that I could go from a... I used to try and explain that to my security guys and employees and everybody else, you know.
I know we've rambled on here, but we've rambled on because we're excited about what we've got in our minds and in our papers. I've brought every damn show here, and it's... Got a ream of papers.
Well, I think we've got a good introduction. I hope we've got your attention. Hope you're going to be interested in listening some more. Meanwhile, go take a look at bostonsbestliverock.com. Go through the shows you were at. Maybe it'll pique your interest.
Exactly.
And get involved.
Yeah, get involved, and we'll chat and see what you think. I mean, we've had some great stories from people that never... I mean, even on the stuff on the Facebook stuff, I says, well, my goodness. Yeah, you were there, definitely, because I remember that.
And our goal here, Dinky and I, is to try to get one of these up a month.
Yeah.
But we're gonna kind of run them all and get them recorded ahead so that we can guarantee there's one a month. So we're going to get six in the bank before we launch. So this is a little teaser.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Definitely. Thanks for listening and happy channels.